it's actually great to follow Seamus. The two things will, you could actually consider this an extended advertisement for Seamus to measure our samples. It's a 50-minute long ad. And I would be happy to see inhomogeneity in our samples, but I suspect it's going to be ordered inhomogeneity if it gets seen. Also connecting to Seamus, there's that barium oxide layer he's supposed to be measuring, just to remind you. That's Alex de Lausanne's image of done on Seamus's microscope of the barium oxide layer in our YBCO crystals. That's just a
omega resistance.
Oh,
no ohms. So that's a
resistance outside.
So the work I'm going to talk about is stuff I do with Walter Hardy at UBC and a group of students, and I'm going to feature pretty prominently the material side of the thing done by a material scientist, Ruixing Liang. And I know Walter Hardy gave a pretty detailed talk here in August about the microwave properties, so I thought I'd actually spend rather less time than I normally would on that and focus a bit more on the materials and talk a bit about the phase diagram, which is a somewhat daunting thing to do because I'm parachuting into this gang who've been talking about the phase diagram for months now, I think, and I don't really know what you've been saying, but I'll try and give a somewhat different viewpoint. A starting point for why we got so interested in defects in these materials and in trying to do a really good job of these materials is now, with hindsight, the reason for doing that was this discovery that we have a dx squared minus y squared pairing state, and in that state a lot of the low temperature properties that people are measuring in order to figure out what's going on have to do with excitations around these nodes here, and those are pretty delicate in terms of the impact of impurities on them, which is a large part of the reason why this linear temperature dependence of the superfluid density at low temperatures wasn't uncovered for the first 6 years of ITC. It has to do with the delicacy of the superconducting state in contrast to the sort of robustness of TC of the materials. That was a bit of a puzzle for a long time. So the first lesson that dealing with the schmutz, getting the dirt out of the materials, was just in finding that linear temperature dependence of penetration depth and then uncovering the D-wave nature of the pairing state. And we just got lessons over and over and over again that when you clean the materials up or dirty the materials, you have a huge impact on the properties. So the proof in the pudding, from at least the point of view of spectroscopy around the nodes for that linear penetration depth, was to deliberately dirty it up by putting some zinc in, and really a very small amount of zinc, roughly a tenth of a percent zinc substitution onto the copper sites, completely kills the linear term and the penetration depth and turns it over to a quadratic temperature dependence, which if you don't measure it too precisely sort of looks exponential. You might not think it does, but it's possible to make T squared look sort of exponential. Actually, T squared was just seen for years in the cuprates and people were just shrugging it off.
And what would be the corresponding percent for nickel?
Nickel really doesn't make it T-squared very fast at all. In fact, the only thing we've ever put in that gives a quadratic term is the zinc. And we suspect that it's just anything that really punches a hole in the copper oxide, so zinc or possibly a copper vacancy, which might be the culprit in thin films, or if you put magnesium or lithium, some sort of really dead ion, onto the copper oxide layer, it's probably going to do this. But nickel really keeps it pretty linear. It generates lots of scattering, but it doesn't seem to be strongly pair breaking. Calcium on the yttrium site doesn't do much. Electron irradiation at an energy that's just knocking the oxygens around didn't do much. So it's really substitutional impurities on planar coppers that make some sort of magnetic hole in the plane seem to be what do this pair breaking. This is nickel doping. I haven't shown the penetration depth, but just as an example, the surface resistance here gets just clobbered. The properties change dramatically as a function of the doping. And these are these two important things here about the superconducting state. The D-wave nodal quasiparticles and contained in this hump here is the long-lived the long lifetime developing of these quasiparticles, and both of those properties are really hammered by impurities in the material.
So you said the lower one is nickel?
Yeah, this one's nickel doping, but the surface resistance haven't shown the penetration depth. The catch here is that this is all done in YBCO whose nominal purity is about 99.9%, and we're changing its properties by adding another tenth of a percent or something. So in some sense, we don't know our ground state or vacuum here, what the zero is. So that was a pretty strong motivation for cleaning up the material a little bit, because we knew we were seeing effects going on at the order of the nominal purity of the samples we were working with at the time. And I'm going to get back to the impact on those properties a little later. Right now, I'm going to make this detour into the materials, because it's turned out in the last year or so that this project to make much higher purity YBCO has opened up kind of some new access to real control over doping in the phase diagram of the material. So at the risk of showing yet another generic phase diagram, I'll just offer this up, and then I'm going to refine it a bit by actually putting some data on this phase diagram as we go along. So we have, I guess, two more or less undisputed phases. People still have the odd argument. There's an antiferromagnetic ordered phase, and a dx squared minus y squared superconductor, and this crossover, if you want to call it that, where this pseudogap opens up into low energy density states is something everyone's putting on their phase diagram now as well. And this phase diagram is actually just covered in question marks when you get to the state of the experiments and the theory as well, I guess. The nature of that pseudogap crossover, whether there's hidden order, the nature of the transitions between the phases, whether there's Fermi liquid spin charge separation, what role stripes are playing in all of this. And I'm not going to answer any of these. But I'm going to spend a little time telling you the road we're going on down that I think will help us answer some of these a little bit better by getting a little more control over the materials. I'm going to start back first by haranguing you a little bit about some language that has sort of crept into the field, which has to do with the history of the chemistry in the field. So here's a messier version of the phase diagram with the antiferromagnet, the superconductor. We have stripes going on in here. We can make static stripes. Something spin glassy. Question mark, real serious question mark out there about whether that's a Fermi liquid. I don't think that's even remotely well tested at all. Things get dicey on both sides of the phase diagram when you make TC low, for largely for chemistry reasons. Out here, the chemistry is problematic, and it's difficult here for most of the materials, and questions of whether there's a new phase in here or not. And we're getting at all of this by hole doping, so that's the theorist's construction there on the axis, and the experimentalist can't actually plot that with any confidence. We can't do what Batlogg's done in the organics these days, which is to dope by just shifting chemical potential with a voltage. We'd love to do that with the cuprates, but we're the trick there is getting a voltage on, a big enough voltage to do something without having breakdown in either your dielectric layer or the material. And these materials are orders of magnitude away from the purity of those organics that Bertram's working with. There are probably other reasons as well. It's not clear why what Batlogg has done has worked, I think. So you can reverse the question. How did he manage to do it? So one of the archetypal versions of doing this is doping lanthanum cuprate with strontium or barium. Archetypal because it's the simple one-layer material, and also because it was the first family discovered by Bidnorth and Mueller. And here's the funny language that's crept in. We talk about lanthanum copper oxide as a parent material, and that the parent materials are some nice, clean, stoichiometric material that's an antiferromagnet, and then we dope it away from that. So there's this mindset that develops that doping always involves some sort of cation disorder or messing up what was a nice material here. And that's true for a lot of them. There really are gross inhomogeneities associated with doping lanthanum cuprate. You're putting strontium on the lanthanum site. and a lot of strontium. You're at strontium 0.15 by the time you get to the maximum TC. And to see the static straits, they even muck it up by adding a little more neodymium. So it's a pretty messy chemistry. Lots and lots of cation disorder.
How far can you go into the orbital regime with strontium doping?
They can go pretty much right over to the other side of the phase diagram, but the material's not in great shape over there, but they can go very far over in doping. You can do a better job of it in the single layer thallium compound. Other examples, the bismuth strontium calcium copper oxide that Seamus was talking about yesterday. For starters, the cation stoichiometry is never this. There's a cross-substitution of those cations from one site to another. You'll always have that. And the doping is via a little bit of extra oxygen. Seamus showed you where that is sitting in the unit cell. So the oxygen is by a small amount of disordered interstitial oxygen. The thallium, single-layer thallium material is not nearly this tidy. There tends to be a lot of copper on the thallium site as one of the doping mechanisms, as well as this off-stoichiometry oxygen controlling the doping that you can anneal in and out. So lots and lots of disorder, but there's nothing intrinsic about that. That's just the way chemistry has worked out. And sort of one of my points of view down here in particular, where we'd like to make really nice underdoped materials, is maybe someone already made a really nice material down there, but it had a low TC and it got thrown out. It's buried deep in Physica C somewhere, and no one's paid any attention to it. And there might be a beautiful, clean, stoichiometric underdoped compound. In fact, we have some of them developing now, and one well-known one, the two-chain yttrium-barium copper oxide, is a beautiful stoichiometric underdoped cuprate. So it doesn't always have to be dirt. So our tack on this is to work on this one rather special material, yttrium-barium copper oxide. And here are this story, in our group at least, and for a lot of people worldwide, is Rixing Liang, who's the crystal grower in our group. So he's been making this stuff for a lot of years now, better and better, and doing a lot of interesting tricks with it. What's special, the reason this material is chosen, is it's a so-called line compound. The cation stoichiometry is fixed. It really is yttrium 1, barium 2, copper 3, and none of those cations like to be on the other site. So it has within it the potential to be much better ordered than most of the cuprate family. The other thing, a lot of people regard the chains as a problem with 1, 2, 3, because if you see some physics, you might worry that the chains are confusing things. But actually, the chains are an incredible gift from God in terms of doping, because they give us a material where the doping layer is fairly far away from the copper oxide planes where the action's going on. This is sort of the closest the cuprates come to something like an aluminum gallium arsenide heterostructure, where the doping layer is quite far away from the copper oxide layer. And now, as we've discovered recently, you can actually order these dopants. So we can make nice stoichiometric ordered phases at different dopings within this phase diagram. So there are reasons why people have plugged away at 1, 2, 3 so heavily, and other reasons why people work on BISCO. And as Seamus pointed out yesterday, there's actually two also almost mutually exclusive classes of experiments that like the different materials in this. There's some work to be done in really crossing that gap. So this is one version of the TCs in this phase diagram, and it was known pretty early on that there's more than one, in fact at least three ordered phases in the chemistry of this material. So you have the nice orderly, if you like to call it, parent compound, that's the antiferromagnet. This has empty copper oxygen chains adding up to CuO6. Missing one oxygen in that copper chain layer. If you fill the chains, or almost fill them, you can't actually quite fill them because the thermodynamics and kinetics work against you actually completely filling those chain sites. But you can get very close to making perfect chains. Then you get slightly over the maximum TC. The maximum's around 6.92 or so, 92% of the chain oxygen's filled. And early on, there was this plateau in the TC of yttrium barium copper oxide at around 60 Kelvin. And as early as 88, Batlog and company, using a I think it was electron diffraction measurement, saw some hints of other oxygen or grains going on in the material, and identified at the very least the so-called ortho-2 phase, which is thought to be the culprit responsible for this plateau and the critical temperature of the material. So what's actually going on with these oxygens is kind of a whole interesting field in its own right. There's an entire little branch of theory involved in the thermodynamics of the oxygen intercalation in this material, because it's you're really intercalating oxygen in at a low temperature and then allowing it to order. So what's nice about this is these chain oxygens are extremely loose. They can be intercalated in and out of the material at temperatures above about 300 degrees Celsius. Below that temperature, not much oxygen moves in and out of the lattice, except maybe right at the surface. So between 300 degrees and when things melt up at 900 degrees or so, there's a whole phase diagram worked out of how to get really controlled amounts of oxygen doped into this chain layer. And then the really sort of interesting thing, and the thing that we've been exploiting most recently, is that these oxygens are actually, they're two-dimensional liquid down to temperatures somewhat below room temperature. So they're actually freely moving at room temperature. And this was shown spectacularly by Veal in the early days of the field when he made something with oxygen about 6.45, quenched it from the high temperature you create that material at to low temperature, no superconductivity. Let it sit at room temperature for a day, 10 Kelvin superconductor. Let it sit at room temperature for a couple more days, 20 Kelvin superconductor. And this is a subtle ordering of these chains, because you don't get charge transfer to the copper oxide planes in this material without getting some chain ordering. That's a minimum chain length you have to make up to get doping. So with these mobile oxygens, then it turns out that there are forces between them and it's possible to get some orderings. That 60 Kelvin plateau is due to this ordering down here, so we have every other chain completely filled with oxygens, every other chain empty. The antiferromagnet, they're all empty. The highest TCs are when you manage to fill all the chains and get the maximum charge transfer to the planes that you can in this material. There's also an ortho-3 phase, two chains full, one chain empty, two full, one empty. And there are these lattice gas calculations of other possible phases. The dream one for me is ortho-3 inverse, which is one chain full, two chains empty, one full, two empty, which would be a very underdoped material. This ortho-7, which is two full, one empty, one full, one empty, two full, and one. I can't even keep them straight after a while. But most of these haven't really been seen, but these ones certainly all exist and can be exploited.
How do I convert X to a whole concentration if I naively assume?
I'll leave that to you. That's one way would be if you think you know what the whole concentration is at the maximum TC, then you can probably tune down by number of full chains. I would maybe do it that way. But there's real, it's a complicated situation, this charge transfer to the plane.
Why is it complicated?
You need these fourfold coordinated coppers. So it's not just the number of oxygens, it's that you don't get charge transfer unless you make the copper in the chain layer fourfold coordinated. So it depends on the degree of order as well as the sheer number of oxygens there. That's what Veal showed by this anyway. The oxygen content wasn't changing.
But assuming that it's perfectly ordered, then
yeah, I would do it just by dividing down the number of chains from optimally to.
I guess as Fulker is saying, I've never really figured it out. I mean, actually, a paper in 1988 which was called Chain Fragment Doping or something, what it's really based along its line. However, I sort of figured that there's sort of a Fulker among experimentalists to look at bond length or something and deduce from that what the effective bond concentration is in 1-2-3, and you're basically saying, there's a very precise way of getting down the amount of loss because it really depends so simply on the order of changes.
Right.
Like that.
So just to give an example of how this is going on, just in one slice of the phase diagram, this ortho-2 phase, at the high temperatures where you're intercalating the oxygen in, this might be done for this oxygen content up at 700 degrees or so in reduced oxygen. At the temperature it's being annealed, it's tetragonal, and the oxygens are just randomly scattered on the two possible sites perpendicular to the coppers. Then as you cool down from that temperature where the intercalation is done, you pass through a tetragonal orthorhombic transition to the ortho-1 phase, which is the symmetry where you're starting to make chains and the A direction is different from the B direction. And that transition is responsible for the fact that we have a twinning problem in YBCO, because when you go through that transition, the material breaks up into domains with the chains running in different directions perpendicular to one another. And this ordering, the oxygens don't have to do much to do all of this stuff, because they're just rotating around coppers like this, and that's part of the reason why it can keep on going at such low temperatures. So at oxygen 6.5, you can have this ortho-1 phase. In fact, you have it all the way down to about 140 degrees Celsius. And then at that rather modest temperature, you finally go through a second transition to the ortho-2 phases, where these organize into much longer chains, roughly separated by empty chains.
Actually, I'm a bit confused. When you are changing this oxygen stoichiometry, is it being changed on the chains?
Yeah, it's just on the chains.
This is the picture on the...
So this is looking at the plane that contains the CUO chains. So you'll never completely fill this plane with oxygen. The most oxygen you can get in is one oxygen per copper on this plane.
So I think I understand why, what is the reason that that you have an ortho-2 phase, that the oxygen arranges itself in every second chain?
Well, there's some combination of repulsive and attractive interactions between the oxygens, and people model these things and produce phase diagrams based on some interaction between the oxygens and the coppers.
Do you also have some distortions of the lattice?
Yeah, so the lattice stretches when it goes into the ortho-1 phase, so the B direction is longer than the A direction. There would be some rather subtle change at the ortho-2. Pardon me?
You could gain something from the kinetic energy of the electrons along the chain.
Yeah, the
models people are using are just, they just put in some potential. And there's actually some interesting physics lying behind this, because this is all happening at the energy scales, small relative to the electronic energy scales we're interested about as physicists. So,
I mean, you explain the doping, basically, by transformation of
So that's interesting, because that couples all of this to the physics we're trying to do as well, which is a sort of an interesting situation. So that's a simplified slice of the phase diagram. You can drop down, go through the tetragonal ortho-1 phase, and then into the ortho-2 phase. This phase is being identified for years now, but only with very small correlation lengths, limited, we now know, by the purity of the materials. And that's the bonus we got with the new very high purity materials we're working with, is that not only did we get a much cleaner material, but we can do these orderings to a much higher degree. The ortho-1 phase now, we can prepare with hundreds of angstrom correlation lengths in the AB plane, and at least a few unit cells in the C direction with the chains lined up on top of each other in the C direction. And before this, there was no order in the C direction, and 50 or 100 angstrom order in the AB plane. So we can make
it's only 6.5.
Yeah, 6.50 is, and if you tread slightly off of that, you run into trouble. It's really quite hard to make it. You have to have this ultra-high purity material to make it really cleanly, and you have to be right on stoichiometry for a reasonable... It's a little more delicate, but our ortho-3 now is at the stage where ortho-2 was 5 years ago. It's pretty good, whereas before it was little more than just a local ordering. So here's a... So maybe when I said I was going to talk about phase diagram, you thought I was going to talk about pseudo-gaps and stuff, but no, actually, the phase diagram, the structural phase diagram of YBCO. So there's the tetragonal state up here, which is coming down as a function of doping. I've sort of dotted it off here because we haven't looked at this in detail in the new high purity materials, and some of this is changing if you have higher purity material where the oxygens don't get frustrated by defects so much. And here's some of these other phases. So the first orthorhombic phase is the ortho 1 phase, which exists over a huge area of the phase diagram, albeit with lots of defects. So the perfectly clean ordered ortho 1 is over here at full oxygen chains, but you can all very defected versions of them. In fact, the reason we found out we had this initially trouble with mobility of the oxygens is with the new high purity crystals, when Rixing tried to make the maximum TC at oxygen 6.91, he got a really broad transition and a sample with horrible pinning, which is kind of depressing after working 2 years of your life to clean up the material and you get a broad transition. And that turns out that the oxygen vacancies here cluster. So if you don't quench this material from high temperature quite quickly, the vacancies cluster and you get a broad transition and a very high pinning material. But it's possible to make sharp 93 Kelvin transitions here. We have the ortho 3 phase here, and this is very schematic now, but it's roughly, the temperature scales are roughly right. You're at about 140, 150 degrees Celsius to make the ortho 1 phase and about 100 degrees Celsius to make the ortho 3 phase. And it's mixed in between them, and I've probably made these wider than they actually are, just so I could fit the ortho 1 inside the dome here, and ortho 2 and ortho 3 inside the dome. Most of the time you get mixed phases if you make the material clean enough. In between here, ortho 2 and ortho 3, we haven't explored up here very much, and down here we get ortho 3 and something else, which I'll get back to. And the stuff you all care about, the superconducting part of the phase diagram, is just down here. So we have short TCs we've looked at, sort of the usual peak through the maximum TC. We've made the ortho 3 phase with sharp transitions. It's around 75 or 80 degrees Kelvin. Really nice samples of the ortho 2 have been available for about a year now with 58 to 60 Kelvin TCs. And the error bars here indicate that in between these points here, we just have broad multi-step transitions. So if you go to 06.55 and let it sit around on your lab bench any length of time, it phase separates out into some mixture of ortho 3 and ortho 2. So you see not just a broad transition, but a transition with distinct steps in it at the ortho 3 phase and then the ortho 2 phase. And I'll get back to this in a moment. So then to run back at the stuff we're doing, we're gradually measuring the microwave properties as we go down in doping. So this is now, I think, probably well known to most people here, is this microwave conductivity this is in the optimally or slightly overdoped material where the chains are as full as we can get them. And we have this microwave conductivity in the AB plane that is the normal state resistive conductivity here, and it rises a factor of 20 or 30 below the superconducting transition. Sharp spike here at TC due to critical fluctuations, which we're just starting to concentrate now and trying to tease out the exponent associated with fluctuations in the conductivity here. But we haven't spent too much time on that. We've been concentrating on the low temperatures. So here we have the huge rise in the conductivity that's being attributed to the long-lived quasiparticles developing at low temperatures in this material. And the frequency dependence also telling you that. And enough frequencies here with this gang of four students we have all working on the same sample at five different frequencies. We can actually slice in temperature this way and look at the conductivity spectrum of the quasiparticles, which turns out, at least for the highly doped YBCO, to have a reasonably boring-looking Drude spectrum, perhaps somewhat surprisingly for some people, with a width that's about 9 gigahertz in the highest purity materials we have. So that's a transport lifetime of 20 picoseconds, or with a reasonable guess at Fermi velocity, 4 micron mean free paths, which is, even though this stuff is awfully clean, you need the restrictions on phase space that the nodal quasiparticles have to really get these huge lifetimes out.
Just further comment, it's really Drucker-like shape to me.
Well, those are honest error bars.
Right.
So within those error bars, I say Drucker shape.
And
these, yeah. So those are fits to Drucker. I think it's not doing so well at low temperatures here. And in the ortho 2 phase, as we get underdoped, it's looking at low temperatures more cusp-like in shape with a long tail. At the optimally doped in the A direction, it's the most, I'm showing you the most Drucker looking spectrum we generate. In the B direction, it has long tails on it. And in the underdoped material, particularly at low temperatures, it's got more of a cusp-shaped behavior here. But what's nice about this spectrum is what's going on here is we have oscillator strength and a delta function at the origin, the superfluid. And as we go up in temperature, that oscillator strength is being shifted out to finite frequencies, the normal fluid oscillator strength. And if you take these Drucker fits and measure up the weight underneath the peaks, it exactly matches the superfluid density that's disappearing from the delta function. So we're really seeing all of the action happening just below 75 gigahertz, and we're keeping track of all the oscillator strengths. So I think these Drucker fits here really capture essentially everything that's going on. And then as we go up in temperature, they start to broaden out extremely rapidly. 50 Kelvin is probably about as high as we can go and bother fitting to this. Much beyond this, they broaden out of our frequency range, and it becomes the job of terahertz and then infrared people to pick up on it. Except you can't do terahertz measurements on these little crystals, unfortunately. So we lose track of the spectrum and its details above about 50 Kelvin.
Why can't you do terahertz?
Because they do transmission, and the real power of terahertz spectroscopy revolves on measuring the real and imaginary parts of the transmission coefficient on a thin film, and that's how they get all their sensitivity out.
And that is the technique which, I mean, you cannot do it. Because you do the usual optical connectivity, you measure only one part, and do the Kramers-Kronig. Is that possible to do in terahertz
made
on a crystal?
It is, but you lose the sensitivity advantage of terahertz when you do that. And the other problem is in the superconducting state, the reflectance is in that frequency range is 99.999%. So you need incredible sensitivity if you can't do transmission. And that's really just not on. Right? Joe Orenstein and I talk about it every year and convince ourselves it's just not possible to do it on these crystals. But you can pick it up again in the infrared and then make some guesses as to what's happening.
Push it infrared down.
Yeah, and we're pushing this up in frequency, so maybe we'll just squeeze the terahertz guys out. But the terahertz has its other interesting advantages for certain kinds of information. So then if we take those widths at face value and call it a quasi-particle scattering rate, this is what we've managed to do with Ruching's 2 years working on cleaning material up. So this is the width plummeting, or the last bit of the plummet. It goes up almost 4 orders of magnitude before you get to TC. So this is just looking at the bit of it when it sweeps down into our frequency range. And here's the flat part, a relatively temperature-independent width at low temperatures. And then coming up really fast, T to the fifth, where it fits in exponential reasonably well, which stimulated, I guess, Mike Walker and Michael Smith to suggest that this was due to quasi-particle scattering, where you're scattering off of nodal quasi-particles off of gapped ones out at the anti-nodes. And explaining that as being the need to have umklapp scattering in order to take up the momentum. We're in the midst of testing whether that holds true in the ortho 2 samples as we change the shape of the Fermi surface and whatnot. But this is the gain we made. The limit down here we think is due to elastic impurity scattering, although it's a little bit of a mystery why that comes out temperature independent in a D-wave superconductor where you have this funny phase space where the nodal quasi-particles are living.
Is the upturn real, or
Well, again, honest error bar, and the reason why the error bar is getting bigger. Two reasons, one of which is related to an earlier question. The first reason is we're just running out of spectral weight here and we don't have much to fit to. The other reason is that I think it's really not so Grutta shaped anymore at the lowest temperatures. And one of Walter Hardy's students is working on a broadband low temperature technique to test that, but seems to be bearing that out, that it's not such a Grutta shaped spectrum once you get to the really, really low temperatures. So I wouldn't put any, I wouldn't go out and start calculating some reason to explain why this turns up a little bit at low temperatures. I think it's as likely as anything to be an artifact of fitting to Grutta peaks in data with almost no signal left.
What's that curve you drew?
This is the fit to T^4, which we just did because we didn't know what to fit it to and wanted to show that it was fast. But it fits exponential just as well with a gap that's some modest, some large fraction of the anti-node gap in YBCU. So now we have these other materials. Now that's, you know, that's only a year's work for these four guys. So we're not finishing the phase diagram all that quickly, but we've done the ortho two now. And you have to do it in the A and B direction, and it takes a while to put it all together. So the ortho two, this is just sort of a picture in ghastly color scheme, but all the glory here of these ordered chains and the bilayers sandwiched in between them. So I won't run through all of the, I guess I didn't give you all of the details, but just to echo what we did in the optimally doped. This looks superficially similar, but the magnitudes are different. There's again, a sharp spike at TC due to critical fluctuations. We still get the rise signaling that we have the long-lived quasiparticles developing again at low temperatures, but it peaks at a really low temperature relative to TC and at a value that's much, much smaller than the value of the peak in the optimally doped material. And that's because the peak is happening at a place where there's almost no quasiparticles left, so they're still long-lived, but they're not generating much conductivity. And it's a little easier to see what's happening there if we just jump straight to, notwithstanding the fact that I just said that the ortho-2 is not as Grutta-shaped, there's still some characteristic width that comes out of the frequency dependence here. So we can still do fits, although they don't work out as well. We can get some characteristic scattering rate describing the transport.
So he's talking about 1 Kelvin?
1.2, that's how far you pump, just pump liquid helium valves. We can go to low temperature, in principle, go to lower temperature than that with the broadband technique. Well, we've applied for money for a demagnetization fridge to cool the broadband experiment. So the broadband experiment is probably you'll see some data in the not too distant future. It's instead of at the discrete frequencies, it's actually measuring a full spectrum from a few megahertz up to, at the present time, about 22 gigahertz. So capturing the frequency range where most of this stuff is going on. But its sensitivity improves as you go down in temperature because it's bolometric. We're just measuring the temperature rise of the sample when you hit it with microwaves. Yes, you mean AB anisotropy? So this is A-axis. All the stuff I've been showing is perpendicular with chains, so presumably just telling us about planes. Though I think this is always just telling us about planes in either direction. The reason I say that is in the B direction, certainly in optimally doped, we've pretty much finished that, and the essentially everything is just scaled up by doubling the amount of fluid you have in the B direction. The widths come out the same, the temperature dependence of the width comes out the same. The only difference is the conductivity spectrum looks like it has a long tail on it that isn't seen in the A direction, and the speculation is that long tail might be the the chain conductivity, not developing a long lifetime. Because these chains are still, if they're really chains, sort of one-dimensional, and they're pretty dirty chains, even though we've almost filled the chains at 6.993, and that's more than 0.5% defects, I can't imagine them developing long lifetimes. So that seems plausible to me, which means the anisotropy we see is an anisotropy in superfluid density and in the normal fluid density in the planes. Yeah, we've done it in this one as well now, and it also comes out about the same in both directions. Yeah, so I guess it was a suggestion this summer just to come back to stuff that's been happening at the ITP. Morris Rice was wondering if this difference in the temperature dependence was some change of the Umklapp scenario when you change the Brillouin zone due to the ortho 2 ordering, but we don't see any substantial difference between the A and B directions in the ortho 2 phase. So.
But now, you know, that would be, at least your lowest temperatures are compatible with D-wave quasi particles, right? You've got linear.
Yeah, I am hesitant to even fit this at this point because, and I haven't showed you the spectra really don't fit quite as well, and we don't have a good model. Yeah, because we maybe have something Drude shaped and a long tail, and we don't know how to split up the oscillator strength between the two.
Looks like it could fit with a linear turn below 10 kelvin.
Yeah, it looks like it starts out like that, but the thing that's happening here is at the same time the shape is kind of evolving and getting a little more cusp-like down here. So we're actually a little, the reason you haven't seen this in print yet is we're still a little worried about the details of this temperature dependence.
What's the shape you expect for a clean D-wave?
Linear.
But as a function of frequency, yeah. Do you expect a
not
Drude
shape?
No.
But let's see, as a function of temperature, at any given at a low frequency, it should go like T squared.
Right.
Right, which you don't see.
Which we never have seen.
You know, that would go along with this going like T.
So the D-wave quasi-particle guys are, you know, working really hard on that, but there's been some, this constant width with a Drude line shape was not expected at all, and that's something that's still being worked on. Other people here might have some comments on where that's going, but I shy away from it because the last time I thrashed it at Stanford, Bob Laughlin said, look, anyone can write down some good model where you can get those quasi-particles to have a nice Drude line shape.
Can you use the adjective good in there?
No, I think any theorist. Maybe he said any decent theorist.
Yeah, I would have described it as a good model. Yeah. I should say anyone can write up a model.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Patrick, is it anything to do with the universal? Some number of quasi-particles
connecting
to the
genome. Pardon me?
There was some prediction.
Yeah, that's, we're sort of within factors of 2 and 3 of that number, but the
universal,
yes.
Yeah, which actually isn't universal.
Because that's a temperature independent.
So that's a matter of where these are coming to.
Yeah, so
down,
what is
down
the
here.
Limit in those units?
It's about something where? Like a half or so of the normal state conductivity. Yeah. So it's we're down in the ballpark, but there's factors of 2 and 3. But
and you actually expect it to be reduced in the conductivity from vertex corrections? Is that how it goes?
Is that how it goes?
The
vertex corrections.
The universal limit goes down in the conductivity because of vertex corrections.
There's some fermi liquid corrections.
And they reduce it, or they can go either way.
I think it goes down.
It does depend on the anisotropy of scattering. Let's say not the fermi liquid, but the vertex ones, right? One which you consider depend on whether forward or just backward scattering would be more important. More, right? If I talk about vertex corrections.
Yeah, I think, if you have scattering between them, though,
right.
Then...
So,
yeah.
So it can go either way depending on which one is stronger, right? That's the...
Mm-hmm.
Is that the correct statement, or?
I'm not sure it can go either way. And the correction certainly depends on your model for scattering.
Yeah, I mean, you need backscattering too.
We can keep working really hard on this, and I think the theorists have to as well, would be the short answer. But I've come to regard it as a little bit of a detail. So I put another point on here and didn't say anything about it, and that's what I want to finish with. So we were getting pretty discouraged. I really wanted to find this ortho 3 inverse. And so Ruixing Liang went straight to oxygen 6 1/3 and didn't find any ordering and got a broad transition. It turns out that as he went down in doping, he kept still making the ortho 2 phase plus some other broad mess of superconductivity coming in at lower temperatures. And then suddenly, and it was looking like TC was going to go to zero just when we finally got rid of the ortho 2 phase, and that we'd never have anything very satisfactory. And then bang, a sharp transition at oxygen 6.29.
Did you show this non-Grother shape like conductivity?
No. I can show that to you privately. It's just I don't like to show too many spectra. Having sat through a lot of photo emission talks myself. And people thank me when I don't show too many spectra. But for the aficionados, I have piles of spectra you can come and look at. So this is this new sample. So initially, Ruixing thought it had about a 5 or 6 Kelvin TC. That's what we were muttering about a little at the meeting in August. He had done a quick anneal. So now this is all going on the benchtop. In fact, I'm threatening to farm these out to theorists so they can each tend their own little crystal and keep its temperature about right in order to map out that. Because it's quite laborious once you have to do these little anneals close to room temperature and try and figure out what exactly the right condition is for a sharp TC. And I was feeling miserably at it, except I had wisely left a couple of the crystals sitting in a desiccator while I played around with the annealing schedule. And when I went back after 2 months, so that was back in August, Ruixing did that. And around October, I discovered that the ones that I had done nothing to and just left sitting in the desiccator had a nice sharp 12 Kelvin superconducting transition. So just annealing at room temperature. And in fact, at a half a gauss, so these are measured in order to get decent signal in little crystals, you measure magnetization with the field perpendicular to the thin little plate, which is a bad geometry in terms of getting penetration. You get penetration way before HC1. So this is actually substantially broadened by the half-gauss field. And one of Catherine Moeller's students is now measuring with a very sensitive Hall probe and is getting something like 1/10 of a degree wide transitions in this 12 Kelvin superconductor if you measure below a 1/10 of a gauss or so.
So you have a 12 Kelvin superconductor at 0.29 and then you go a little bit up in doping, there's no TC zero? Or
then you get some mess of TC with going all the way up to 58 Kelvin. So you're making some amount of the ortho 2 phase.
But you had, on the first graph that you showed, there was a point at 0.375 or something like this, which was TC to zero.
Oh yeah. Well, that's the point here, right? We're changing the phase diagram by ordering the oxygen a bit. So
is there still a TC equal to zero compound at 0.375 or?
Well, if you were to anything below this one here, in fact, anything below this one here, if you quench it from the temperature where you set the oxygen content, you'll get TC equal to zero.
Okay.
Because
you haven't made chains.
I mean, films always seem to go to zero by 0.4 or something.
But that's, you need to to allow these oxygens to order, and the strains move them. You can't actually make this phase really well if you don't detwin the crystal ahead of time, because the strains associated with twins are enough to frustrate the ordering. So it's sort of hopeless in a film, I think. So we have this low TC, which probably a few people would be around here would be interested in a clean low TC material. We know that's the sum total of the experimental data on this phase right there, except for one little experiment we're working on right now. So we don't have transport or anything like that. But the exciting thing is we're going to definitely be able to go above HC2 with very modest laboratory fields and really map out interesting things like transport and that.
And you have several of these crystals, you know?
Yeah, we just, Rishing just annealed a big batch of them, and he's also going down. He's made 6.28 now, and we're going to see whether that one's still superconducting. And then with hopes of making one that's not superconducting and then playing around with photodoping it is another game to play with here.
Do you have X-ray diffraction to show that the chains are actually
open? I would really love to know whether this is an ordered phase, and Martin Grevin's going to look at it in the next couple of weeks at the Stanford Synchrotron. But we don't know right now. It's that kind of a funny content. So.
And do you know if it's orthorhombic?
It's definitely orthorhombic because you can see the twinning.
Okay.
So it's made chainlets at the very least, and whether or not they're ordered, I don't know.
So do you know that this actually is 3 prime and a 4 prime, for example? Can it be every 4 chains?
I don't think even in the lattice gas models that they... I don't think they have an every 4 chain one.
Hmm.
I don't think the models that get some of the phase diagram right here actually have the every fourth chain one. There's a one that has a sort of a root 2 by root 2 structure with a big diamond shaped unit cell and no real chains, but we haven't seen that one either.
How much of it is superconducting? How much of it is the phase?
Yeah, I can't really answer that very cleanly from this measurement.
1/10 or 50%.
Well, the whole thing's superconducting because
okay.
we see vortices all over the place in it when we cool it down, which brings. Yeah, we've done a little bit more, which brings me to the cliffhanger. So I'm having great fun in Catherine Moeller's lab, learning about scanning microscopies of varying sorts. And either good or bad news for some people is that there was this happenstance that simultaneous with getting this low TC material was CAM students getting the scanning squid susceptometers and magnetometers up and running for looking at vortices in these materials. And this is what one of these things looks at. So this is stuff I'm doing with CAM and Brian Gardner and Janice Wynn in her group. So this is, the inner thing here is the scanning squid magnetometer that you all know of from sort of the Kirtley measurements and CAM's measurements on the interlayer vortices. So this is a pickup loop connected to a squid that's off the scene here somewhere. And what's being added to the design is a drive coil, niobium drive coil around it. So you can apply a DC or an AC magnetic field locally and measure that susceptibility. So you can do magnetometry, susceptibility, and fairly crude topography with the tip here. Though not anymore since we've ground it down, scraping it across holes. So, of course, the first fun thing we're trying was suggested here. So this is a smallish crystal of this underdoped YVCO produced when CAM. The problem with the magnetometer Catherine has set up is that it has about a 60 by 60 micron scan range, and because it's done with piezoelectric transducers, Kirtley's is a slower thing but with a much larger scan range, so he can look at every vortex in a great big superconductor and know everything that's going on. The smaller scan range restricts us, but I just said, well, I'll just make a crystal the size of your scan range. Mm-hmm. So this is about a 40 micron by 40 micron crystal that I cleaved by hand with a razor blade.
control this stuff.
It came about because Cam said, gee, it'd be great to do this, but it's impossible. And I said, well, I can do that. And she said, you cannot. But I didn't drill the hole myself. So that got done by focused ion beam. And it's embedded. You can't see these anymore, so just the actual problem. It's easy to make this. It's hard to keep track of it once you've made one of these. So it's embedded in silver epoxy, both to keep track of it and because the ion beam is a charged beam boring technique, so you need it to be on a conducting surface.
What's that square pattern on the hole?
That's just a little, there's a little ion, little radiation damage, presumably from the boring. Pardon me?
In that nice square pattern?
Yeah, no, it's something to do with the details of the...
How they make the hole.
How they make the hole, yeah.
And then they drop something
in the hole. The beauty of the central experiment is it's a topological experiment. So all of these questions about how yucky it looks, all that matters is that it's not cracked. And then this is a susceptometer image. So this is looking at the AC magnetometry signal driven by the AC coil around it. So just scanning across this thing with the susceptometer, and there you can see the hole in the crystal. And then there's various ways to do this that we have to talk about. But the easiest way to get vortices in is just to cool this thing down in a little bit of a background field. And we've sort of quantified what fields we can get a certain number of vortices. So this is now a DC magnetometry image with the drive coil shut off and then the background field nulled. So you don't really see the sample here, but this is two flux quanta sitting in the hole. We can make 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 flux quanta sitting in the hole of one of these. This is actually one that's annealed at a little above room temperature, so it has an 8.5 Kelvin superconducting transition. And then I stop there. maybe we can discuss a few things when Cam's here tomorrow. We haven't done the cleanest experiment on this yet, but we want to talk to people about how best to do the cleanest version of the experiment. And maybe Cam will say a few things tomorrow to people about the other experiment that's going on, which is looking for the vortex quantization, HC over E versus HC over 2E, which is being done systematically at lower and lower TCs. It's being done now already in the 12 Kelvin sample and has yet to be done in something at lower TCs. The 12 Kelvin's unsatisfactory right now because these are niobium squids and you can't get close to TC. You can only get up to about 7 degrees. So we haven't really explored this window where one might see HC over E vortices yet, but we're sort of within a hair's breadth of it. So it's ending with an honest question mark. We're not quite done yet. Plus Cam had a pump blow up on the weekend, so I thought it was going to come with slightly more. Thanks. And I'm here for 2 weeks to take suggestions of good experiments to do with these underdoped materials, essentially. So I just wanted to stimulate thinking about what to do. Transport's already pretty much at the top of the list.
What's the magnetization look like on the small crystal?
As a function of temperature?
Yeah.
Well, that's the catch, is that the TC is a little above the TC of the squid. Uh-huh. So that's why it's not clean right now. We really want to do this experiment on a sample where we can measure the TC in situ of the sample that we're seeing vortices in. And we don't have a sample. We just missed. This one was an 8.5 Kelvin transition, and the squid craps out at about 8 degrees, so we just missed it. But it's doable in a very short time scale. The other thing is probably there'll be a switch to using scanning Hall microscopy, which doesn't have the problem of a TC of a probe, and somewhat higher resolution.
So can shamans do STM on some of these, you know, like ortho 3 phases or something?
Yeah, but like
samples or?
Number one priority is the 12 Kelvin samples, I think.
Yeah, and although you don't actually know that they're ortho 2,
no,
but
no.
Or 3 inverse or whatever you call them. But what, you know, what about, I guess when you say ortho 2, that's really well established, right?
Yeah.
But you haven't actually looked at the ortho.
The instrument's evolving, right, in order to do 1PCO.
And Martin can do X-ray scattering on those kind of crystals, so you'll have the structure.
Sure. Yeah, he can do it on the size crystal we have then.
Who's that?
Martin Revan.
So what, they're just missing like neutron scattering?
Well, neutron scattering is never going to be done on this stuff. Because
well,
you can't.
Why do you say never? Why couldn't you eventually make a centimeter cube?
I don't think he, I think it would be really hard to make it clean enough to get this kind of ordering going on. I mean, we're trying, we've made half decent ortho too, I think, but I don't think.
Yeah, but when you say never, you know, that's a long time.
What is the
time? Within the time range of my patience for neutron scatterers.
Can you do neutron scattering? Maybe not quite as well, but if you have a collection of oriented crystals?
No, the collections actually tend out to, you've seen pictures of those, but I was talking to them, and actually the mosaics tend to be unsatisfactory. You can do it with 4 or 5, but you're not going to do it with 100 individually oriented pieces.
So neutron scattering never has a meaning. If you extrapolate the number of neutrons available, zero.
So we should get a little done before before that happens. There is some things that they can do with a much smaller sample, and I've been talking to both Keimer and Martin Grevin about just what kind of measurements they could do. If I said I can't give you anything bigger than 2 by 4 by 1 millimeter. I mean, we can make a reasonable size little piece of the stuff, and there are some experiments they could do.
No evidence of any transport in the along the chains so far.
It doesn't look like it to me.
You have no idea which direction these nodes are.
No, I think that's a job for the tunneling folks. If they make enough tricrystal junctions, they can figure out exactly where the nodes are, I guess. The microwave measurement that held out some promise of doing that was the nonlinear Meissner effect. But since the nonlinear Meissner effect hasn't turned out to look like what was predicted, i.e. it doesn't actually have any anisotropy at all, and it's not a good way of finding the nodes.
What about just nonlinear response to electric field?
Yeah, so there's not just nonlinear as well. One I've thought about occasionally is non-local response to an electromagnetic field. Because once you have non-local electrodynamics, then you can see the. So you have the problem with electromagnetism that the nature of the tensor is that you can't see 1-1-0 physics because you just see a vector sum of 1-0-0 and 0-1-0. But that's only true in linear response, and if you have nonlinear electrodynamics. So the experiment... all of the stuff we've done, or the vast majority of the stuff we've done, so this is the C direction. We put the RF field like this. So we're running currents across the face, and that's still local electrodynamics because the mean free path in the C direction is still really short. But if you take this sample, and we're just doing this now, one of my students has figured out how to polish nice slabs. So if you cut this off, and generate really nice slab like this, with that being the z direction, and then run your currents across this face by running with the RF magnetic field this way, then you're sensitive to the mean free path the quasi-particles can escape into the bulk in the planar directions. And then you'll pick off non-local effects depending, that will depend upon what the vector perpendicular is here. So you can cut slabs that have 100 faces or 110 faces or other different faces and look for differences. But that's, I think, for obvious reasons, a hard experiment to do. But it's possible, and we're trying to do that. Certainly early on, Maureen Redick and Tom Timisk saw somewhat different behavior in this plane than they did doing the A-axis for light coming in the C-direction, which was already a hint that in the infrared they're seeing some non-local electrodynamics. And they saw something, I think, different in the 110 direction as well. So there's probably something to be exploited there. But it's a hard experiment because you have to make this face, and whenever you cut and polish, you have to prove that you haven't done something to the surface to ruin what's going on, and that's the hard part.
So you can certainly measure the temperature dependence of penetration in these samples, right? Yeah, because we need more data
points. Oh, in the underdope samples, yeah.
Yeah, this, yeah. Well, this 12K one, because we need more data points on the doping, yeah, dependence.
And it's actually getting into the range where the microwave work has the problem that it just measures the temperature dependent part, and we're stuck with relatively few techniques that measure lambda of zero very well. Mm-hmm. But lambda of zero is going to be getting pretty big in 12 Kelvin YBCO.
Well, how big is it roughly?
I'll take the Uemura scaling if you like. It's going to be a. Well, no, we don't. But if you take that, you get something in the micron range, and that's a lot easier to measure than a 1200 angstrom penetration depth. So there's some more possibilities for measuring that. So I think it's with some work by a few different groups, we're going to get nice numbers down there.
Is there a way of taking the whole concentration of the 12 degree material experimentally, or some idea?
Well. No, the classic thing is Hall effect, right? But the Hall effect is a bit weird in cuprates. some people have ideas of techniques that tell you what the full concentration is, but
only has a magic formula to explain
this magic formula. Right, yeah. Other people think the thermopower is, tells us quite nicely what the whole concentration is. I think Loram and company have used that. But I'll just, my phase diagram has oxygen content on that.
If you had a theory of the thermopower, that might.
Right, yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot, Doug.